Dear Chairman, welcome you. We would like to welcome you in the first place. We are used to speaking English in our committee when we receive foreign guests, but today we benefit from the assistance of our interpretation. So if the colleagues wish to speak in Portuguese, you please do so. And myself, I will as well speak in my own language. So, queria manifestar-lhe, em nome da Comissão dos Negócios Estrangeiros e das Comunidades Portuguesas, e também em nome da Comissão dos Assuntos Europeus da Assembleia da República, as boas-vindas ao Sr. Erik Solheim, cujo trabalho nós conhecemos e apreciamos, e queríamos registar a sua vinda a esta Comissão, e valorizamos muito o facto de ter considerado importante trocar pontos de vista com as nossas comissões da Assembleia da República. Temos entre nós um conjunto muito representativo de deputados da Assembleia da República, do Partido Social Democrata, que em Portugal, embora tenha esta designação, é o grande partido do centro-direita, do Partido Socialista, que é o grande partido do centro-esquerda, dos democratas cristãos e do Bloco de Esquerda. Sou deputado do Bloco de Esquerda, que também está aqui entre nós. Portanto, só não temos aqui o Partido Comunista. De resto, todos os partidos estão aqui representados. Posto isto, queria dizer-lhe, em jeito de introdução, que a Assembleia da República está ciente da insuficiência da contribuição portuguesa para a ajuda ao desenvolvimento, em particular nos últimos anos, que foram marcados por grandes dificuldades económicas, grandes exiguidade de recursos financeiros para atender a necessidades básicas inerentes ao funcionamento das instituições e do nosso Estado Social, e que essa situação de extrema dependência em que o país viu na contingência de recorrer à assistência externa criaram limitações muito grandes e que tiveram um reflexo negativo na contribuição portuguesa para a ajuda ao desenvolvimento. Em todo o caso, Portugal permanece um país persuadido da necessidade da colaboração da comunidade internacional e, em particular, do mundo mais rico, mais favorecido, contribuir para pôr de pé os mecanismos que contribuam para a aproximação no plano dos padrões de vida e também no plano institucional dos países do mundo em desenvolvimento. Portugal tem responsabilidades especiais para com os países que integraram a esfera colonial portuguesa do passado e que hoje, numa organização de iguais, se reúnem no âmbito da CPLP, e tem procurado, sendo responsabilidades históricas particulares para com esta comunidade de países, e é para eles que vem direcionando os recursos que tem conseguido consignar a este apoio. Eu gostava de dar a palavra ao Sr. Chairman Erik Solheim, e se estivesse de acordo, depois íamos convidar os diferentes partidos políticos para o interpelarem e colocarem as questões que considerarem pertinentes. Sr. Deputada, Sr. Presidente da Comissão de Assuntos Europeus, deseja usar da palavra, dá-lhe a palavra, faz favor, Sr. Presidente.
Muito obrigada, Sr. Presidente da Comissão dos Negócios Estrangeiros. Breves palavras de boas-vindas ao Sr. Erik Solheim por estarem entre nós aqui no Parlamento Nacional e dizer-lhe que é um gosto tê-lo connosco para a apresentação deste relatório da OCDE sobre o desenvolvimento e cooperação de Portugal 2016, no seguimento daquilo que foi acabado de dizer pelo Sr. Presidente da Comissão dos Negócios Estrangeiros, dizer que a nossa ajuda é uma ajuda proporcional aos nossos meios financeiros e à nossa capacidade, no momento em que vivemos medidas de austeridade, podermos ter disponibilidade financeira para concretizarmos aquela que é uma ambição solidária, quer na Europa, quer no mundo, e tendo em atenção também que temos propósitos humanitários muito específicos e muito direcionados àquelas que foram as nossas ex-colónias e que têm, em algumas delas, necessidade de uma ajuda ao desenvolvimento muito particular. Mas apraz-nos registar que fazemos parte de um clube europeu, a União Europeia, que tem no seu, como seu acervo mais distintivo o facto de ser um dos maiores contribuintes líquidos para a ajuda ao desenvolvimento no mundo. E por isso nós, por essa via, sentimos-nos recompensados e participantes ativos e proativos nesta ajuda, que tem que ser uma ajuda cada vez mais presente para fazer face às grandes dificuldades e às grandes desigualdades que o mundo globalizado sempre impõe. Por isso, Sr. Chairman Eric Solheim, mais uma vez seja bem-vindo, é um gosto tê-lo cá e saber que a instituição, que é também uma nossa instituição, podemos considerar assim, está atenta ao papel de Portugal nesta questão tão importante que é a ajuda ao desenvolvimento. Muito obrigada.
Convidava então o Chairman a fazer o favor então de usar da palavra. Faz favor. I have to press the button over there for the interpretation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and excuse me for speaking in English rather than in Portuguese. I'm fully aware that Portuguese is the fifth or sixth biggest language in the world, something like that. So it's number.
Well, it's the first in the southern hemisphere.
Yeah. It's one of the most important languages on the planet. Let's agree upon that for sure. And it's one of the most beautiful. So sorry for not being able to speak that. And I'll try to speak somewhat slow. If you can't follow me in my English with Norwegian accent, you just tell me. Let me first say I'm feeling so pleased being in the parliament. I spent 12 years myself in the Norwegian parliament, most of the time in the Committee for Foreign Affairs. So of course I can look to the similarities between your system and ours, and it's you have a very, very beautiful building here, which I really, really, really appreciate, and such a fantastic day also in Lisbon with beautiful weather. We really want to bring that weather to Northern Europe, that's for sure, such a clear sky and a nice time. So what I intend to do is, number one, briefly to set out how I see the broad situation in the world. Secondly, the main drivers and how Portugal can potentially contribute more. And finally, some words about development finance, which is a key topic. But first of all, I'm of the view, contrary to nearly everything you hear in the media, that the world is not on the verge of the abyss and rapidly moving to hell, which is the basic concept you get in the media. To the contrary, there is rapid overall progress on nearly every way of measuring it. We are living at the most lucky time in human history. The average human being is much better off than at any other point. If you want one figure, I propose the following: 7 million. 7 million, that is the number of children who live today who died in 1990. There are 7 million more children who are able to grow up compared to 1990 because of the enormous progress in health, nutrition, fight against poverty. And these numbers are astonishing. I mean, just one nation, Ethiopia alone, the rapid decline in child mortality in Ethiopia has saved more lives than all killed in all global wars combined. So we are not speaking about small numbers. They're huge numbers, but of course these were people dying one by one in huts and cabins all over Africa and other poor parts of the world, not dying in one big event covered by the big media. But if 7 million children today have been killed in big events of terrorism or wars, there would have been no other story in world media. That would have been the number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 story. So this is, we should celebrate this enormous progress. Last year was the first year in human history where there was not one single polio case at the entire continent of Africa. So there is huge progress, and we tend to underestimate it, and we tend to speak only of the problems. even on violence, very contrary to people's belief, we are living in the most, at the most peaceful singular moment in human history. Chance of being murdered in Lisbon at the time of Vasco da Gama or Magellan would have been at least 10 times higher than it is today. On every way of measuring it, there is much less chance of dying in violence. Even from wars, how horrible as the civil war in Syria is, let's remind ourselves that 10 times the amount were killed in Korea or 10 times in Vietnam, and even the Rwanda genocide killed 3 times as many people in 3 months that has been killed in the entire civil war in Syria up to now. But this is, of course, no consolation to the person who's seen her family dying in Syria, but we need to get it somewhat into perspective. If the past was another country, it was a much more violent one. I'm happy to discuss this if you will dispute the overall picture, but I think we need to get it right. And then, of course, it's interesting to identify what are the main reasons why we are making progress and see how we can make these, how we can strengthen these progress, and what will be the potential role of Portugal. So let me identify 4 main success factors. Number 1 is much better states. That is very, very hard to develop if the chief of any state is the biggest crook in the land, filling his or her pockets. We have very corrupt states. And the idea which you sometimes see on the very right of politics, that you can do without state, it's completely wrong. You need a strong state to provide law and order, peace, frame the market, etc. And all the really big success stories of development, the South Koreas, the Singapores, the Chinas, in Africa, the Ethiopias, the Rwandas, they are all about having a functioning state, development-oriented state, and not perfect, but good leadership. So you need a state. And of course, Portugal here has, to me, a very particular role to play in some of the Lusophone countries. Some of them have very weak states. Some of them have hardly any state at all, like Guinea-Bissau, which has been fragile from the very beginning. And you can play, I think, a very, very constructive and important role in assisting the Prime Minister and President of Guinea-Bissau to come together and to gradually build a state in Guinea-Bissau which can serve its inhabitants. Without a state, development is maybe not impossible, but it's for sure very, very difficult. And I can give you, but if you want one example, the average South Koreans today are 390 times richer than their grandparents were at the time of the Korean War, not just during the war, but after the Korean War. So it's enormous progress possible if you have a development-oriented state. But while sometimes the people on the extreme right makes it goes wrong when it comes to the state, sometimes people on the extreme left make it wrong when it comes to the second factor, you need a market-based economy. No place has been really developing without a market-based economy. This is not to say that you can, there should not have any regulation, for sure. I mean, the Koreas, the Chinas, the Singapores have a regulated market, but they understood the role of the private sector and encouraged development. Singapore in 1960s, when the state was formed, had a GDP per capita of $450. Now it's at the level of $55,000, probably the richest nation on the world. I mean, depending on how you measure it in competition with Luxembourg and Switzerland and a few others of being the richest nation on the planet. Happened like that. And a major reason for sure is that it provided a hub for private investment and a market-based economy. So, and this is also an area for Portuguese activities. We believe you should use your development assistance to blend with private sector to provide the ground for private sector investment. You have a number of companies which could do more for development, and of course in particular maybe in Lusophone part of the world, Portuguese companies are seen as key to development. So please build upon what has happened and see if you can do more in blending development aid with private investment to take some of the risk out of the private investment so that you get more private investment. There is a lot more money in this. Globally, there are more than 100 times more money in private investment than in development aid, so the numbers speak for themselves. You need a market-based economy and you need private investment. Thirdly, you need to focus on education. All the really big success stories have been about a strict focus on education. In the OECD, we're good at measuring, and if you look to the measurement at the moment, all the best performers of the world when it comes to education are in the Far East. Number one is Singapore, number two is South Korea, number three is Japan. But even poor Vietnam are now doing better for the 15-year-olds in school than Portugal or Norway. Indeed, Vietnam is doing better than any nation in Europe when it comes to 15 years old in school. I mean, who would have thought that at the time of the Vietnam War, that these nations could so rapidly move into such an astonishing positive result? So we have a lot to learn, but education is a key to development everywhere. You cannot have a modern economy unless you have an educated population. Again, Portugal has a lot to offer, because not just on language. I know that you're doing a lot in providing Portuguese language education to the world, which is good, but that is not just about language. It's of course about the overall performance of students, where language is one part, so a strong emphasis on education is important. Fourth factor I will mention is that the global system is working. People tend to speak as if the UN doesn't achieve anything or that the global community don't perform. And sure, there is a huge number of difficulties and the performance in number of cases. We have not been able to provide the environment for a peaceful settlement to the Syrian war or the Yemen war, for instance. So sure, there are deficiencies. But overall, it's working much better than it did at any other point in human history. And at the core of this is a somewhat good relationship between the two main powers of our era, the United States of America and China. If that breaks up, nothing will happen. But what happened last year was astonishing. Financing for Development Conference in Addis Ababa, setting the Sustainable Development Goals in New York, Paris Climate Convention, the big powers were able to overcome difficulties and set a global agenda, which we all agreed upon. That's a very good result. And the role of the UN, but as well as OECD here, I think is crucial. And we should not speak it down. We should speak positively about this, while of course repairing all the deficiencies. So if you sum up this, better states or market-based economy, focus on education and a working global system, you have the main reasons for success, and Portugal can fit very, very well in to do more. Let me finally zoom in upon finance, because that's our core competence. Finance is not the most important for development. No one has claimed that Singapore had much more money than anyone else. If the Gang of Four still had been in power in China, for sure China would still have remained poor. It was the policies which were driving the change, which was the key element in success. And all the real success stories on development is about getting the overall policies right. If you want another example, look to the island of Hispaniola. The Dominican Republic is 6 times richer than Haiti per capita. If you fly over the island, you see the difference from the air. Wherever it's green, it's the Dominican Republic. Wherever it's brown, it's Haiti. You can see when there is no more trees, it's Haiti. Why? Well, 100 years back, Haiti was richer per capita than the Dominican Republic. But the Dominican were blessed with, not perfect, but with somewhat benevolent, somewhat far-sighted dictators. They were not pure Democrats. Even some of them were environmentalists, and they wanted to develop the land. Haiti had to work with some of the most corrupt and stupid dictators of any time, anywhere. And that has provided for an enormous now difference, and it's about policies, not about anything else. South Korea and North Korea is of course the same. The South Koreans are such a success story, North Korea such a mess. Same nation, same culture, same religion, same everything, except the difference in policies. So policies are by far the most important, and that's your competence in the parliament to advise government and everyone about that. But if you get the policies somewhat right, finances help. But you cannot replace a bad policy with good finance. But then there are 3 main sources of finance: aid, private investment, and tax. On aid, we have a very clear encouragement to Portugal. I know that it's difficult, but that is a step up spending. The peer review, which is here, tells some a positive message about Portugal. You are not arrogant, as some other powers are. You are able to work with people on an equal basis. You are respected by everyone. Your development assistance helps. It's respecting country systems where you work. So it's a good story to tell. But the development spending has come down very substantially, basically year by year. But you are now past the bottom of your economic crisis. Portugal is on the way up again. You should step up spending. And if you want to look to positive examples here, of course, the United Kingdom, with a conservative government, the time of crisis, have made 0.7, achieved 0.7 as the first major power in the world. Turkey is another example. Turkey is poorer than Portugal per capita. It's a middle-income country, but still Turkey is far above Portugal in its development spending per capita. And I think the reason is that both the British and the Turkish leaders have seen development aid not just as a way of providing solidarity. For sure, it's also about solidarity with poorer people, but it's also about an enlightened foreign policy. If a nation wants to influence the world, you need this tool. And at the end, nearly all huge problems which can affect Portugal will come from abroad. Terrorism, for sure, will come from abroad. Drugs are coming from abroad. Environmental crisis may come from abroad. Huge flows of migrants, which are affecting Northern Europe, are for sure coming from abroad. So you need, and at the end, if you need want markets for the companies, you need to work with the rest of the world. And in this world, development aid is a very, very important concept and tool for an enlightened foreign policy. That's the British and the Turkish view, and that's why they have stepped up so substantially. But our encouragement to Portugal is make a trajectory. No one expects you to go like that to 0.7. But make a gradual increase in your development spending and you will have more influence in the world. Secondly, private finance, I've touched upon it. You have a lot to offer, many companies you could invest, and private investment is much, much bigger flow than aid, and you can use the aid to leverage some of the risks of the private sector. Finally, tax is also much bigger than aid. Much bigger than aid, even in the poor nations. Nearly all education in the world are paid for by the taxpayers, not by Portugal or Europe or UNICEF or UNESCO. It's paid by the taxpayers of that nation. And if we can increase the tax revenue of the developing world with just 1%, which is a very, very modest target, that's double all global development aid. So there's an enormous potential source for better health, better education, from tax, even in poor nations. It's also a matter of global fairness. Rich people, whether they live in rich nations like the United States or in poor nations, should pay taxes. We cannot have a system where someone can avoid this, and that's why, from the opposite side, we are working very, very hard to tighten the tax loopholes, to stop the abuse of tax havens, and to stop the system where global companies are moving the profits from one nation to the other so that they don't pay taxes. I just on finance now, but give one example. Chancellor Osborne, the finance minister of the United Kingdom, who's want low taxes in the UK, but he makes it very clear that if you want low taxes, those who should pay must pay. And three of the major American companies, Google, Microsoft, and Starbucks, do not pay taxes in the UK. If they don't pay taxes in the UK, you think they pay taxes in Nepal or Ecuador or the Central African Republic? I mean, the answer, I think, is obvious to everyone. This cannot continue. You global companies should pay taxes, and we need to focus in on tax transparency and tax payment in the world. If we and the ideal policy where you have low tax levels, that those who should pay must pay. So to sum up, Portugal have and you can of course assist by development aid in setting a better tax system. Portugal has a lot to offer. You have very few enemies, if any. I have never heard of that. You're a respected nation, beloved nation, so people will listen to you. So please step up, identify areas where you can provide global leadership. Spend some money, but leadership is sometimes more important than money, because we are now in a new interconnected world where we are all in it together, and we need leadership. And Parliament for sure has a strong role to play in pushing government to leadership, but also providing leadership by itself in many areas. So thanks for listening, and let's move on to debate and discussion.
Thank you very much, Chairman. It was very interesting to listen to you and to your perspective. You know, Portugal is a very ancient nation. We have been here for almost 1,000 years. We left our territory in order to meet those that today we call people in first third world and then developing world. An history and an experience of a national decline gave us enormous humility towards these situations. We try to do the best we can with the resources we have and trying to work with those we assist with great respect and the full knowledge of the things they can do within their own context. If people working for municipalities in Mozambique explain that they have to pay members of assemblies in municipalities because if not, they cannot even buy a shirt to attend municipalities. Sometimes we have to face the Swedish aid, which finds ethically unacceptable that members of municipalities or members of assemblies have some public income coming from development aid money in order to give them the basic things they consider required by their dignity. So we are very flexible, we are very humble, and we work with those we try to help with limited resources. We reached China in the 16th century, where we found a civilization and an economy which was richer and had a higher GDP per capita than Europe. So this we don't have the messianic or millenaristic belief that we are going to change the world. We just do what we can within our resources and possibilities. Also, the examples of Singapore and South Korea are not very easily replicated, because the solutions which were adopted as development strategies for these countries would today be unacceptable. Not only the authoritarian political regimes which, in an enlightened way, presided the development of these nations, but also the market protection for those strategic areas which in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, these countries decided to put outside world markets, so to develop their competences in areas which they considered strategic. As you know, the spirit of the time and the mainstream economic beliefs of our time are very much in contradiction with insisting producing bad and expensive products just because we believe more one day in the future we will be able to be competitive and put in the market something excellent in a very strategic goods market. So it's not so easy to say, hello Guinea, watch Singapore and do something about it. It really not work like that. As you'd like, we will try to engage in the efforts over which you very well preside. You are the one who have a global understanding of the efforts which rich nations are able to put forward in order to bring some solidarity and decency in a rather cruel and brutal world. We all know the role big European, Western, Mediterranean, Iberian, American, Scandinavian companies have, for instance, in Africa, where they have predatory practices. And since the Portuguese are there, we have been there, we are still there, we witness what is taking place over there. So I think there are many fields in which a useful role can be played. Always having in mind that we have to be humble and work together with those we would like to help, because often they are very much more aware than we are of what kind of help they could actually appreciate and thank for. And well, I'd like to give you just few thoughts. I don't know if other colleagues would like to have the floor. Alguém quer falar? Sr. Deputado, faz favor, por primeiro a pedir, tem a palavra. Diga quem é, faz favor.
Muito obrigado. Helder Amaral, do Partido Democrata Cristão, CDS, aqui no Parlamento. Queria cumprimentar o Sr. Eric Solem, dizer que registamos com agrado e cumprimentamos-lo pelo excelente relatório. Concordamos que ele ajuda a perceber que nem tudo está tão mal como às vezes a percepção das notícias e do dia-a-dia nos indica, mas é um facto que enquanto houver uma criança, um problema que seja no mundo, como dizem bem, mais rico do que o que já foi no passado, mas ainda assim não tão justo como também era desejável, temos ainda trabalho a fazer. Eu considero que a cooperação é talvez do soft power a melhor arma. Ela é decisiva. Ela não tem que ser standardizada, ou seja, quero dizer com isso aquilo que acabou por vos deixar aqui. Nós devemos usar cooperação de acordo com a realidade com que enfrentamos. Portugal tem uma experiência diferente, única, com os países de língua oficial portuguesa e com outros países com que temos relações centenárias. E essa nossa experiência não pode ser replicada, mas não tem que ser necessariamente igual a outras. E por isso, uma das minhas questões era como é que nós conseguimos, como aqui já foi dito, nós temos em todos os partidos um largo consenso em matéria de política externa, em matéria de cooperação não foge à regra, temos de facto recursos que são menos do que desejaríamos, fruto das nossas circunstâncias, mas ainda assim, às vezes menos recursos não quer dizer menos resultados. O que é que eu quero dizer com isso? Precisamos ser focados, precisamos de perceber bem que outras áreas, que outras necessidades, às vezes que requerem menos recursos financeiros, e para não reduzirmos tudo aos recursos financeiros, que possam ter efeitos, quer naquilo que diz que era fundamental, que é a boa governação, e ela é o primeiro passo para resolver um conjunto de outros problemas, mas também na área da educação, essencialmente da saúde. Eu julgo que a saúde estará na ordem do dia da agenda internacional, porque deparamos com problemas novos. Em alguns países que estão, felizmente, a atingir níveis de desenvolvimento e de crescimento, mas que têm dentro de si problemas, nomeadamente em termos alimentares, e esses problemas alimentares normalmente vão diretos à economia local, ou seja, se não produzirem, se não consumirem produtos que são da sua própria produção, acabam por não potenciar a sua economia, não fazem uma economia sustentável, não valorizam o seu território. E eu acho que é evidente que o melhor recurso até agora é o recurso das pessoas, mas também é evidente que o recurso endógeno e a sustentabilidade, para também podermos com isso entrar naquilo que são os compromissos e as metas de sustentabilidade ambiental, precisam que as boas práticas que utilizamos, nomeadamente na Europa e em alguns países, como deu o exemplo da Ásia, possam ser replicadas. Não sei se aí é o recurso financeiros que possam ser decisivos ou são os recursos técnicos e a capacidade técnica de cooperação técnica e, obviamente, também na cooperação da educação e do intercâmbio de informação. Gostava de saber também se, apesar de tudo, em termos globais, para além da boa governação, se fazemos uma avaliação de riscos ou de mapas de risco, do que é que pode surgir. Não prevíamos há uns anos, embora estivesse latente, os problemas que hoje temos na Síria, mas tivemos um conjunto de países que foram fazendo um esforço enorme, nomeadamente através das suas populações, para se aproximarem de modelos de boa governação, para se aproximarem de modelos democráticos, com características diferentes, mas nós aqui, como disse bem, nós somos exímios em respeitar a realidade de cada país e gostamos de o fazer. O que eu digo é como é que nós podemos proteger os sinais positivos. E qual é a melhor forma de cooperação para, às vezes, quando damos um passo em frente, não detectarmos que, por força ou de uma má cooperação, ou de um foco não tão objetivo, não conseguimos proteger os bons sinais e acabamos por agredir. Temos vários exemplos em que isso aconteceu. Portanto, era, no fundo, ter uma perspectiva. Fazemos coisas boas, mas o que é que ainda podemos melhorar? O que é que podemos ir para além da necessidade de recursos financeiros? E que outras áreas nos poderiam sugerir que um país como Portugal pode ainda assim cooperar? Foi dando algumas. Eu sou grande adepto das cooperações multilaterais, não só bilaterais. Não parece que seja algo que os países possam fazer por si próprios, mas acho que a visão global, no mundo global, como falou aí bem, empresas globais têm que ter responsabilidades globais e têm que ter, obviamente, cumprimentos globais, mas para isso precisamos também de uma cooperação e concertação entre Estados e entre países, para que possamos todos ter um modelo ou um guião de boas práticas para que possamos seguir. Era só, terminando e cumprimentando mais uma vez e agradecendo a exposição que fez. Muito obrigado.
Muito obrigado, deputado Helder Amaral. Tem a palavra o deputado Paulo Neves.
Muito obrigado, Sr. Presidente. Mr. Chairman, welcome to the Portuguese Parliament. I'm a member of the Social Democratic Party. Thank you for your very interesting and complete speech. I will speak in Portuguese. It's my language and I am in Portuguese Parliament. Muito obrigado pela sua intervenção, muito interessante e bastante completa. Queria dar as boas-vindas a toda a delegação da OCDE, incluindo e destacando naturalmente a Sra. Ana Paula Fernandes, da delegação portuguesa em Paris. Senhora Chairman, ouviu com muita atenção a sua intervenção, deixe-me, no entanto, lhe fazer só uma breve introdução que compreenderá. Portugal é um país, há muitos anos, muito solidário. Aliás, queria agradecer as suas simpáticas palavras de dizer que o nosso país tem muito para oferecer e é uma nação bastante respeitada. Sublinho essa sua simpatia e, de facto, é uma verdade. Portugal é um país muito solidário, tem uma diplomacia global que aposta muito na diplomacia da paz e tem uma total consciência dos benefícios que a cooperação tem a nível mundial. É por isso que agradecemos este seu trabalho do relatório da OCDE, uma instituição que Portugal faz parte e que tem uma posição sempre muito ativa, porque destacamos a importância que a OCDE tem. O relatório que nos trouxe é muito completo, é bastante objetivo, muito realista e apresentam-nos, aliás, no final, sugestões de processos de melhoria, o que deve ser sempre destacado neste tipo de relatório. Como deve ter reparado, Portugal passou, e o relatório, aliás, é muito fiel a isso mesmo, e o senhor Presidente da Comissão também falou dessa situação, a situação financeira que Portugal passou nos últimos anos e que felizmente está a recuperar. E naturalmente que essa situação financeira teve reflexos na cooperação portuguesa, mas não tantos, e o próprio relatório reconhece, não tanto como poderia ser de esperar. Felizmente, nós também continuamos, apesar da situação difícil que o país atravessou, continuamos a apostar e bastante na cooperação e, como o relatório também o reconhece, através de algumas reformas nessa cooperação, como foi juntar a cooperação ao Instituto Camões. Eu pedia também que se levasse em conta a estratégia de Portugal a nível de cooperação, que é uma estratégia de grande aproximação aos países da Cplp, aos países que historicamente nós temos uma relação muito forte, não só do ponto de vista emocional, cultural, da língua, mas também comunitário. E de facto este relatório também destaca isso, quando faz destaques sobre a Guiné-Bissau e também sobre São Tomé e Príncipe, destacando o papel importantíssimo que Portugal tem no apoio a estes dois países. Também destacam no relatório, e é uma verdade, que nós também apoiamos agências como o Banco Mundial, a CPLP, que é uma organização, e outras agências das Nações Unidas, tendo como objetivo apoiá-las no seu trabalho de cooperação. Também um memorando de Portugal 2015 feito pelo Camões e que os senhores fazem, e muito bem, questão que faça parte do relatório, que eu comparei com outros países e que este é muito mais completo, quando nós chamamos a atenção que a nossa cooperação faz também através das universidades, que se tem cooperação também através das municipalidades, através do setor privado e da sociedade civil. E isso penso que é uma atenção que nós dispensamos, felizmente. Também, para terminar, uma palavra da nossa grande preocupação e o acompanhamento muito grande que nós fazemos em relação a países que têm muita necessidade de cooperação, como é a Guiné-Bissau, e que somos, de longe, aqueles que mais apoiamos, o que isso denota a nossa forte preocupação com aqueles que falam a nossa língua. Também agradecer-vos todos os processos que sugerem ao governo português de implementar, de corrigir e de melhorar. Vejo isso sempre como processos de melhoria e, segundo os números que nos apresentam, andamos à volta dos 70% a cumprir com as vossas sugestões, o que é um bom nível para o nosso país. Para terminar, duas perguntas que gostava muito de vos colocar. A primeira, tendo em conta que, e é bom que se reflita também sobre isso, que se Portugal ainda está longe dos 0,7 recomendados em termos de cooperação, a verdade é que estamos à frente em per capita do Japão, à frente dos Estados Unidos, à frente da Espanha e da Itália em valor per capita de cooperação. Mas eu queria colocar-vos duas perguntas. Como é que julgam que nós poderíamos ainda ter um papel mais importante com os países da CPLP? Qual é que é a importância que identificam em Portugal ou do papel de Portugal na cooperação e ajuda ao desenvolvimento dos países da CPLP? Como é que podemos melhorar isso? Segunda pergunta. Na sua intervenção, o Sr. Eric Solheim fez uma referência aos conflitos e à paz. E eu reparei no relatório que nos apresentam que se fala mesmo no Conflict, Peace and Security e que Portugal ainda contribui muito pouco para esta parte. Mas, como sabem, Portugal é o país da diplomacia global e da diplomacia da paz. Como é que nós podemos melhorar a nossa performance neste item do Conflict, Peace and Security? Muito obrigado. Muito
obrigado, Paulo Neves. Tem a palavra a sua deputada Susana Amador.
Boa tarde a todos e a todas. I will speak first in English, just to greet you, to welcome here at Lisbon, at the Portuguese Parliament, our House of Democracy, and it's a pleasure to receive you and to greet you about all your work in this so important committee and for the quality of the report and all the recommendations on this report. So it's a pleasure and welcome you here at Lisbon. Depois desta nota inicial, queria também, em nome do Partido Socialista, dizer que para nós e para o Partido Socialista, cada vez mais, cooperar não é ajudar, cooperar é desenvolvimento, e a palavra cooperação confunde-se com desenvolvimento. Longe vão os tempos em que a palavra ajuda não tinha uma visão estratégica e integradora, e, portanto, hoje a palavra ajuda deve ser substituída por desenvolvimento, porque cooperação é, de facto, isso mesmo. E em relação ao relatório, dizer que, obviamente, da parte do Partido Socialista, identificamos todas as notas positivas do mesmo e também a propositura e as recomendações que fazem no mesmo, tal como foi sublinhado pelo Sr. Presidente Sérgio Sousa Pinto e também pelos demais antecessores. Portugal atravessou um período severo, com uma crise severa, e tudo isso se refletiu, obviamente, também nesta área, que é uma área que que foi sempre estratégica para Portugal e que, independentemente dos partidos que se sucederam na governação, foi uma área de continuidade e de aposta portanto, nesta opção de cooperar e de trabalhar para o desenvolvimento, quer ao nível da Cplp, quer ao nível de outros países com os quais Portugal tem especiais preocupações ao nível dos direitos humanos e ao nível da componente económica e social. E, portanto, estamos certos que nos próximos tempos podemos retomar alguma linha de força, de investimento, mas de continuidade em políticas que nesta matéria, felizmente, não têm sofrido grandes descontinuidades e tem havido um fio condutor importante e contínuo. Dizer ainda que, no que diz respeito às áreas de intervenção, a questão que gostaria de colocar é se a par daquilo que têm sido as áreas mais desenvolvidas ao longo dos anos, que têm sido a educação, a saúde e o ambiente, se a par destas áreas que nós entendemos ser estratégicas, designadamente a educação, como foi sublinhado também já por si, porque é a área-chave e a área que decide tudo, porque é na educação que tudo começa e que tudo acaba, e é através da educação que conseguimos combater e esbater as desigualdades, e sobretudo a educação das raparigas e a educação que muitas vezes é discriminada num conjunto de países, portanto deixando para trás as jovens raparigas e também criando depois desigualdades futuras nas mulheres. A par destas áreas, se entende que áreas como a energia e outros setores também merecerão da parte de Portugal algum desenvolvimento futuro e potenciação futura. A segunda nota que queria também transmitir é a que tem relacionado com o poder local. Há em Portugal o poder local e os municípios portugueses sempre tiveram uma tradição de cooperação para o desenvolvimento, mas têm-no feito de forma, digamos, pouco harmoniosa e, portanto, cada município tem desenvolvido, em função também dos seus interesses, áreas e cooperações com países, e até que ponto Portugal poderia beneficiar com esta força que é o poder local, de forma mais harmonizada e mais sustentável, a par da força da ciência e da academia, que também, a meu ver, pode ser maximizada, e o papel que aqui o setor social, o terceiro setor em Portugal, que também tem desenvolvido, mas lá está. A verdade é que há vários atores a trabalhar, inclusive também no privado, mas era importante harmonizarmos, provavelmente, e maximizar todas estas energias. Muito obrigada.
Obrigado, Sra. Deputada. So I'm going to give you the floor, Mr. Chairman, to make the comments you would like in order to respond more or less to so many issues which were raised by colleagues. Please, Chairman.
Thank you so much, and let me try to respond to some of the many important and interesting issues you have brought up. You started with the issue to what extent the world can learn from the fantastic success stories of East Asia. I think it's important to realize that at the time when this started, no one prophesied it. No one thought that it would happen. If you go back to the 1950s, there is not one singular social scientist on the entire planet who said that South Korea is the place with good prospects. To the contrary, you will find a huge number of people saying that, say, Ghana is the promising place, South Korea has no chance. Nor did anyone I have been aware of make any indication that the rise to China would happen. That's the biggest event in the world in our lifetime, for sure, without any comparison. Completely changed the world, and no one thought it possible as late as 1978 when it started with the power of Deng Xiaoping in China. So for sure it can happen. No one can copy anyone else, I mean, that's very clear. But you can learn a lot from successes. And to learn that you need a market-based economy, that you need a state, that you need to emphasize education, these general lessons learned, I think, are basically applicable to all. And some more specific ones as well. I mean, I give you one example on the most promising developments. I mean, Africa hardly has any manufacturing. There is, yes, mines, oil and gas in Africa, but hardly any manufacturing. Africa has less than 1% of the world market. No products you can buy here, basically, are produced in Africa. That is very strange, since it's completely against all economic theories. The salaries, if you are a manufacturer worker in China these days, are 20 times the salaries in China, in Africa. Still, the garment industry remains in China. 60% of all clothes and all shoes on the planet are produced in China. 70% of all mobile phones, I mean, yes, they're designed in Korea or in California, but they're produced in China. So total Chinese dominance, even when the salaries are much, much higher. Why doesn't it happen? Well, the Africans have so far not been able to organize in such a way that it can happen. But that's now starting. In Ethiopia, you have now huge industrial parks. There are two with 30,000 people. The investors are Asian, Chinese, Korean, Bangladeshi, Sri Lankan, Indian investors producing in Ethiopia for the global market, linking up to the great, I mean, the Swedish H&M, for instance, which have shops everywhere. That, unless you can tap into that manufacturing experience, up to these days, hardly any nation have been able to develop. You need to get industrial base to really develop. So I think there is a lot to be learned, though I agree you cannot replicate Korea or Singapore, but for sure you can learn a lot. You don't have the biggest industrial base, true? But to develop just on the basis of services and tourism and other industries has proven itself up to this date very difficult. You need an industrial base, and you cannot start with producing rockets. You need to start with the basic industries, which are nearly everywhere garment and relatively simple. And Africa need to tap into the world market, otherwise it cannot develop. So that's why this is promising, and it's also learning from some of the experiences of Korea, China, Singapore, etc. Then you asked what should Portugal do with limited resources. I mean, you were both touching upon that topic. I'm blunt, but you need to step up the resources, because I know it's difficult, but it's possible, and not possible to do it in 1 year like that, but it's possible to gradually increase the resources for development. Turkey has done it, the United Kingdom has done it, many nations have done it. You need to explain it to the people why it's useful to do it, because politicians cannot do this without explaining to people. But I think people can understand.
GDP comparable to South Korea. It is not our case.
But Mr. Cameron has done it at a time when he had cut down on nearly everything else. He made two exceptions from his cuts, development assistance and health. Except for that, he has cut everywhere. If you go to the pubs of Glasgow or Birmingham, that will not necessarily be popular. But he has done it because he thought it was right, and because he believed that it increases the UK influence in the world. But I'm not saying you should copy the United Kingdom, but just say that you must also increase the resources if you want to use this as a foreign policy tool. But even if you increase the resources, for sure you will not be the United States of America. You cannot influence everything in the world. You need to focus, but smaller nations can have a lot of influence if they provide leadership in some areas. The United States may, but they are not able to either, lead in every area. Small nations can only lead in a few areas. But you can define a couple of areas where you can lead and do that. You cannot lead on peace everywhere either, and no one can do that, but you can lead on peace processes and conflict management in one or two places. There is basically, I mean, very frank, no one else in the world takes an interest in Guinea-Bissau. No one else. You take, so please use that position to always be close to the parties in the conflict there, the Prime Minister and the President, to alert the international community, bring other donors on board, and take the lead role which you need to take. I mean, France can lead in Central African Republic, probably Portugal cannot. The United States may lead in South Sudan, Portugal can potentially not. But you can lead in Guinea-Bissau and maybe some of the other Lusophone countries.
I don't know if it is taken in consideration as add money. The money we spent with our navy patrolling those seas to stop drugs trafficking, which is corroding the Guinea state. We are the only ones over there with our ships policing those waters. That's decisive for statehood in Guinea.
Yes, some of the, I mean, you may explain, but some of these items will be are considered development aid, some are not. I mean, military expenditures in general are not. However, it may be useful, even if it's not considered development aid. But some expenditures in these areas are considered development assistance. But you need to focus if you want to influence the world. But you have a new, eager Secretary of State, which we just met. She would for sure be happy to do that with support and encouragement from Parliament. And you can leverage more resources. I mean, encouraging civil society actors, business for sure, so that the resources will have more wide-ranging impact than just the public money. You are much better placed to answer your own question on how you can play a role with the other Lusophone countries, because they have separate issues. Brazil, as we know, has one of the biggest, maybe the biggest drop in its GDP per capita of any nation at the moment, so they have huge domestic problems. Timor-Leste and Angola maybe they have difficult times because of the oil price. Timor-Leste is just out of a conflict, but they have done that in a very impressive way. But I think both Angola and Timor-Leste may have difficulties with the low oil price, but I think you are better placed. But overall, some of these nations are successes, and if you compare Mozambique today with the Mozambique at the end of the Civil War, it's a huge, huge progress, though there are still some uncertainty, but still, overall, it has been a remarkable way forward. Finally, to your question, the beauty of what happened last year was that the world agreed that we will have one integrated agenda, sustainable development agenda. In the past, we had very separate, there was an environment and a development agenda, also economic growth and social agenda, these were separate. And they were separate to a remarkable extent. There were different governments, there were different ministries, different UN institutions, even different civil society actors. Now we have one agenda, and we need to always to look to, when it comes to the spending, how we can get the absolute maximum effect of the money, which for instance would be to provide renewable energies, which will of course improve both environment and development at the same time. And if we make a solar plant, and Morocco, by the way, and your neighbor is a world leader now in solar energy. It's about the biggest solar energy plants in the world. But if you provide solar energy to Africa, you improve environment and development at the same time in accordance with this agenda. Sorry.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Kovacs, I'd like to say that we feel privileged that we could have you within us in the Foreign Affairs Committees and the European Affairs Committee, and we wish you all successes in your decisive work and your very important efforts for a more decent world. Thank you very much.